Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For graphic designer and freelance journalist Carlos Moreno, his first exposure to the Tulsa race massacre began when he was doing work in the Greenwood District for his clients shortly after moving here in 1998. Then the Oklahoma Eagle asked him to put out a special edition of the newspaper highlighting the findings from the 2001 Tulsa Race Riot Commission report, as it was known then. That led to learning more about the tragic episode and the much fuller history of Greenwood. That education has led to a kid's book about the Tulsa Race Massacre, a book for families to have a tool to help explain the event, and now a series of portraits of the people who built Greenwood in the 19-teens, survived and witnessed the massacre in 1921, then helped rebuild the community and resisted the forces that wanted to prevent its return to vibrancy, and the witnesses that later shared the long-hidden story and preserved the history. His book is titled The Victory of Greenwood. Carlos Moreno is a graphic designer for CAP Oklahoma. He's a freelance journalist and a collector of memorabilia, books, and photographs from Tulsa's Greenwood neighborhood. And he joins us today to talk about his new book, The Victory of Greenwood, today on Studio Tulsa. Carlos Moreno, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Victory of Greenwood tells the story of a lot of the people that were present when the Tulsa Race Massacre occurred in 1921. It tells their story before and after those terrible, tragic days, as well as other people who helped keep the story alive later, who were some of the first victims to recount their story. What was the impetus for this book?
Yeah, you know, I moved here from California in the late 90s, and it was really the community of Greenwood that gave me kind of my first shot.
As a graphic designer, right?
Yeah, I was a young graphic designer, young entrepreneur, didn't really know my way around the city. And it was places like the Greenwood Cultural Center, the Mabel Little House, the Oklahoma Jazz Hall of Fame, the Oklahoma Eagle that were really all my first clients, you know, kind of coming up. And I was doing some freelance work for the Oklahoma Eagle and was asked by the managing editor at the time, Lewis Gray, if I would be willing to collaborate on the special issue. At the time, they wanted to create a special issue about the 2001 Race Massacre Commission report. As you know, the report's 200 pages long. It's really academic. And so they really wanted to bring it down to something that was digestible by their readers and had, you know, photographs and some of their own archives and stuff like that. So I immediately said yes to the job and then went to the bookstore to learn how to do print design, because I hadn't ever done any sort of print design before. So that was certainly an adventure. And I learned about really the history of Greenwood, not just the massacre itself, but the entire history of the neighborhood from people like E.L. Goodwin Jr. and Don Ross, and certainly Jim Goodwin, and, you know, the staff at the Eagle and all the people who would come in and out on a daily basis, you know, all the elders who were around at the time. And it's a real, it's a story that really stuck with me ever since. You know, it's never left me.
Moving to Oklahoma from California in 1998, did you have any inkling of the race massacre?
I didn't know anything about Tulsa at all. You know, I was surprised that there were lakes nearby. You know, I was kind of expecting, you know, a plains type of environment. And, you know, so I was pleasantly surprised. My wife and I joke to this day, you know, I didn't think that I would see any trees or water.
Right. You know, but well, I'm assuming you began learning this story in drips and drabs as you began working with some of these clients, right?
Yeah, as you know, I got to know people in Tulsa and especially in Greenwood. I got to know, you know, the story of the neighborhood, the story of the leaders of the neighborhood, the people that they look up to at the time. And a lot of these survivors in the late 90s, early 2000s were still around. Mabel Little was still around, yeah, and very active in the community. So I got to know her a little bit. You know, and there were other elders who were speaking out about this. Otis Clark, Dr. Olivia Hooker, certainly Eddie Faye Gates. I was fortunate to get to know her while she was collecting the stories of the survivors for the report. So yeah, I kind of felt like I was learning at the same time as kind of everybody else was learning.
So you put together this special issue, which sort of collated the report into a more readable narrative, if you will. So now, 20 years later, you come back with this book, The Victory of Greenwood. What was the story you wanted to tell with this particular book?
I had, at the end of 2016, I had just finished 20 years later, like you said, you know, fast forward, I've got a pretty good career as a graphic designer. I had just finished working with Ann Patton on her book, Unmasked, about the history of the Klan in Indiana. And we'd come off of that project and started talking, and I was kind of asking her, you know, what's next? What, you know, are you going to write another book? She'd written a few books before, and she really wanted to do something about Greenwood. And she kind of said, you know, you should write this book about Greenwood. And I said, you know, Miss Patton, I don't know how to write a book. But it was another one of those things where it was just like I had the passion to do it, and I had been collecting all this material and all these books about Greenwood. And, you know, the more I thought about it, and I actually went back to a lot of the people that I knew in the Greenwood community and kind of asked them, you know, I'm not black, I'm not from here, I'm not from Greenwood, I don't have family connections, you know, am I really the right person to tell this story? And everyone that I talked to said, yeah, you know, you've got the passion, you've got the right intent, and you want to honor the people that were significant in Greenwood's history. So, you know, that kind of set my mind at ease that, you know, yes, I was, you know, kind of the right person to tell this story, going beyond when I looked at all the bookshelves. You just see, you know, book after book, and the covers are these black and white photographs of the destroyed, you know, Greenwood area. And certainly that story needs to be told, of course. But I intentionally called my book The Victory of Greenwood because I wanted to focus on the good things that had come out of the community and all the influences that Greenwood had, not only on the city, but on the country as a whole. You know, I think people really don't realize Greenwood's historical significance in American history.
Obviously for those few days, but beyond those few days, what do you see as that influence to the city and to the, you know, the larger country?
Yeah, there's a couple of examples. One would be, this story isn't in the book, but I tell it to everyone who will listen. Count Basie stayed in Greenwood in 1927. So, you know, you've got the massacre that occurs in 21. Greenwood rebuilds, becomes a thriving community by the mid-20s. And here's, you know, Count Basie with all the other, you know, jazz musicians who came through town to play, you know, in this area. So he stays in the, I can't remember the name of the hotel, but he stays in a hotel in Greenwood. And he hears this music and he thinks, you know, it must be somebody playing a record in one of the rooms. So this is the middle of the night. So he's kind of wandering around the hotel, knocking on doors in his robe, you know, trying to find out where this music is coming from. And he runs into somebody who says, you know, no, this isn't in the hotel. This music is coming from down on the street. So he rushes down into the street. He's still, you know, in his pajamas and robe, you know, just goes down into the street and he hears the Oklahoma Blue Devils.
Right.
And they're playing their music, and he's so enthralled and so inspired by this music that it really changes his whole sound and his whole approach to jazz.
In fact, he took some of the members of the Blue Devil, that became the first members of the Count Basie band.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, Count Basie becomes Count Basie because of Greenwood. And this is in the first chapter of Count Basie's autobiography is all about Greenwood. Mm-hmm. So you have this national musical, you know, influence that sort of goes all across the country and all across the world, really. And another example, a much more modern example, is my chapter on Emmett J. McHenry. Here's someone who, you know, grew up in Greenwood, graduated Booker T, went on to work for IBM, and after that became the founder of Network Solutions. And if you registered a domain name in the 90s, you were registering it from Network Solutions, and that was Emmett J. McHenry. You know, he's plays a big role in the development of the commercial internet. So, you know, if you own a website, you've got Emmett J. McHenry to thank for that.
There you go. The name of the book is The Victory of Greenwood. My guest today, Carlos Moreno, a graphic designer, freelance reporter, does some work for Focus Black Oklahoma. He's a graphic designer at CAP Oklahoma. And he's done a couple of books over the last year or so on Greenwood. One is a kid's book about the Tulsa Race Massacre, and now The Victory of Greenwood, in which you tell the story of a lot of the people that we've been hearing about over the last few months during the commemoration of the massacre, people like O.W. Gurley, A.J. Smitherson. But beyond telling what happened around those days, you tell a fuller story of them, how they came to Greenwood, how they made their wealth. And more importantly, you also capture the losses they had from the race massacre and making a not overt case for reparations, but maybe a subtextual case for reparations, because from all of these losses many people have experienced, they were never able to recapture the wealth they had before the race massacre. Many left. The ones that stayed never experienced the same level of wealth creation that they had before the race massacre. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, the neighborhood as a whole, you know, if you look at Greenwood of the, you know, before 1921, of the teens and, you know, early 20s, they do rebuild. Like I said, there's video footage. Reverend Solomon Sir Jones captured some video footage of 1924 Greenwood, which is just fascinating. But if you look at Greenwood in the 40s, especially leading into the 50s, as a community, the Greenwood was a very thriving neighborhood and arguably bigger and better than it was pre-1921. But I go into, like you said, the individual stories. And so I really wanted to personalize this for readers. A lot of the books that I, you know, had read about Greenwood were very academic, sort of historical books, which obviously is hugely important. But I really wanted to tell a much more personal story and have the reader get to know who these folks were, get to know, you know, people like you said, A.J. Smitherman and O.W. Gurley and John and Lulu Williams, and maybe make a personal connection. You know, if you like cars and you're interested in, you know, people who are talented mechanics, you might really like the story of John Williams. Or if you're really into movies, which I'm a huge movie buff, you know, and I really enjoy telling the story of his wife, Lulu Williams, who owned a chain of movie theaters, Dreamland Theater. And then after the massacre in September of 1922, she reopened the Williams Dreamland Theater. So I just really enjoyed telling those stories. And, you know, Mabel Little, who had been through the massacre, but, you know, becomes a really powerful advocate for civil rights and a powerful advocate for desegregation of schools in 1971, and was an activist way up into the late 1990s when I moved here. Mm-hmm. She was still active in the community. So I really wanted people to kind of get a sense, you know, that this wasn't some far or long ago thing that has no connection to the present. You know, I told a lot of the stories of those leaders of Greenwood in the 60s, people like Amos T. Hall and Homer Johnson and George Monroe, people that you may not necessarily know about because they're not sort of the figures of or the most wealthy people in Greenwood, but they played a significant part in Greenwood's history.
And those particular people played a particular role because they were the first witnesses that spoke up in many cases.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, these stories were in danger of being lost because they were kept hidden away for decades. And people like George Monroe and others, they finally began speaking out and saying, here's what happened.
Yeah.
Because, you know, after 30 or 40 years of not talking about it, there's a community that thinks, well, what did happen? Or did anything happen?
Absolutely.
And those folks are important for that reason. And being the first witnesses to really speak up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to take you back to the early folks that you write about, like Dr. A.C. Jackson, of course, his tragic death during the massacre, and J.B. Stradford. You tell the story of how they gained their wealth, like O.W. Gurley, for example. I think he came across in the land run and settled near Perry, and sort of Perry was no man's land where anything went, and he made money there, and then eventually he came to Greenwood. All of these folks they came from other places, and eventually they were attracted to something in Greenwood. What was it exactly? Was it the fact that there was oil and money?
That was part of it. I think that was probably a huge motivator for O.W. Gurley and his wife, Emma. O.W. Gurley had a pretty nice job. He was appointed to his position with the post office by President Grover Cleveland. So, you know, to have a presidential appointment was a pretty big deal, especially for a black man during this time. But he leaves that post because during Cleveland's administration, of course, you have the Indian Allotment Act was passed and the Dawes Act was passed. So he sort of had a front row seat into what was happening in this place called Indian Territory. And he says to himself, you know, I want to be a part of that. I want to own some land and be a part of this land run and see what this is all about and see if I can make my own fortune. So he participates in the fourth land run, Cherokee Strip, for the, you know, Oklahoma history enthusiasts. And yes, exactly. He settles in Perry and sets up a general store and you know, they make a pretty good living. But then they find out that, oh, you know, hey, there's oil to been discovered in Tulsa in 1901 and then again in 1905. So they say, you know, we really got to get in on this because a lot of people are going to be, you know, settling in this area and wanting to buy land and wanting to develop. So we really want to be a part of this new economy that's coming to Tulsa. So they move from Perry down to Tulsa. The first land deed that would become, you know, in this new area that would become the neighborhood of Greenwood, the street was already named Greenwood. And the land deed was kind of right near the corner of Greenwood and Archer. So where one would think Greenwood is today is, you know, where it started.
And Gurley had the first land deed.
Yeah. And in fact, the land deed is in the name of Emma Gurley, which I found to be very interesting. So December 5th, 1905 is the founding of Greenwood. And the land, the first land deed is in the name of Emma Gurley, which, again, I found that was pretty interesting.
Do we know why it was in the wife's name?
I'm not exactly sure. You know, I think that's something that we still have to kind of dig a little bit. And this land we know was originally owned by the Creek and Cherokee tribes. And so, you know, there's an interesting story there that I don't think has been quite explored fully, is how does this land go from being native owned to being black owned within, you know, a pretty short amount of time. So, yeah, I think there's definitely some historical digging that still needs to be done.
You tell some larger stories as well beyond individuals, although there are many individuals that are profiled in Victory of Greenwood. For one, you tell this history of Langston. Why was this important to have in this book about Greenwood?
You asked earlier about, you know, kind of what was the attraction. And for black Americans one or two generations away from slavery, education was one of the most important things in the black community. They felt at the time that education was really their way out of this cycle of poverty, this cycle of oppression, that if they could educate the next generation, that generation would be, you know, prosperous. And that, for the most part, that played out quite well. You had tons of schools that were set up and they were called normal colleges.
Teaching colleges.
Yeah, you see this all over the South, and you certainly see this in Oklahoma. Whenever you see the name Normal College, what it was a college that would teaching future teachers. And Langston, the town of Langston, was established as one of the all-black towns in Indian Territory. But the school of Langston was also established there. And people like Edwin McCabe played a very important role in attracting people to all black towns in Oklahoma. At one point in Oklahoma's history, there was this idea floated that Oklahoma could be an all black state. That idea was quickly squashed. But it was very interesting that in this Indian Territory, black Americans really saw it as a place of great freedom and a great opportunity. And so telling the story of Langston and Langston University and Edwin McCabe is, you know, kind of gives people context as to why did Oklahoma have more all-black towns than any other place in the country? And why was it this place that was so significant in you know, we hear a lot about black migration into places like Chicago and Atlanta and Detroit, but I think not a lot on the national scale is told about the migration to the West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as you were talking earlier about how important education was for those first two generations after slavery, it was also important in this community. And you have a chapter on Booker T. Washington High School, which, you know, if you talk to people of, say, John Hope Franklin's generation and the next generation, there's a veneration of the incredible teachers they had that prepare them for any place in the world. And just as you hear white Tulsans of that age talk about Central High School being the same way, Booker T. Washington was equally that way for African Americans in segregated Tulsa. And you have a chapter on that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, again, being attracted to this place, Ellis Walker Woods walked from Memphis to Tulsa. And that's kind of unimaginable today. You know, I couldn't imagine walking 400 and some odd miles to for a job.
You know. 4 miles is beyond probably.
Yeah, I flew from, you know, San Jose to Tulsa. So that was relatively easy. But yeah, to be so inspired to be a teacher and establish a school, to walk all this way and establish Booker T. Washington just kind of, you know, speaks to the level of motivation and passion that this generation had to teach the next generation, and the fact that Booker T. became such a prominent school in preparation of young kids to go on to mostly HBCUs, and how important historically black colleges and universities became and still are in the black community today. Some of the most prominent black leaders of our generation today come from HBCUs. Right. And even see it in when Beyonce has done performances. She's sort of like her costuming and the use of band members, it all kind of harkens back to that HBCU kind of legacy. Yeah. So we can trace that history, make those connections.
Well, there's really interesting stories through the Victory of Greenwood and essays about various members of the community, but also you have chapters on how black media of the time portrayed the massacre. And you write, rightly so, that a lot of accounts that have stayed with us came from white media, from the newspapers on the white side of Tulsa, or national papers with white audiences. But the black media of the day, the newspapers of that day, like the ones that A.J. Smitherson founded, they also were portraying the massacre. What did you notice about the difference in tone?
Yeah, you see a very different story emerge when you start looking at the Tulsa Star, when you start looking at papers like W.E.B. Du Bois' The Crisis, the Chicago Defender, these prominent black newspapers. The massacre was just as important a story nationally as it was locally, and certainly was covered by national reporters, journalists, investigators. Walter White was an investigator for the NAACP and wrote several articles about the massacre. And so you get a very different picture of the motivations behind the massacre. They knew that this was an attack on the Greenwood neighborhood as an attempt to steal Greenwood's land and move the Greenwood community further to the north in October of 1921. So this is just a couple of months after the massacre itself. You see that there was a report that was written by an attorney, Elijah Scott, out of Topeka, Kansas. And he writes this report getting confessions from Tulsa police officers saying that, yes, the massacre was planned and the Tulsa Police Department played a part in this. And so this was reported by the Associated Negro Press at the time, not a story that you would have read in, the Tulsa World or the Tulsa Tribune, but it was published in black newspapers. And you see a story of Greenwood's rebuilding and recovery and how much the black media celebrated that and how much they wrote about Greenwood's rebuilding. That's where you kind of really get that story. And I think that was pretty well hidden in white media, of the time.
Well, there's lots of good stories in the Victory of Greenwood from how Greenwood was rebuilt through people like Colbert Franklin. You have an essay on him. You also have great entrepreneurs. You mentioned Emmett J. McHenry later, but in the day, Simon Barry, who created maybe the first Uber.
Yeah, I do talk about, you know, Simon Barry being Uber before.
Yeah, he created a jitney service because no taxis would go into the district, and it was a word of mouth.
Absolutely. Yeah, we didn't have cell phones, obviously, in 19-teens, but he buys a Model T Ford and, you know, starts taking people around, and soon, you know, he's got a whole fleet of these open-top Model T Fords, and they're just driving people back and forth, and you would just tell somebody, hey, I need to go to the grocery store today, and word would get around, and eventually, you know, you just wait around for a little while, and there'd be a car pulled up and ready to take you to where you need to go, and probably along the way, there'd be several other passengers that would pile into the car, and, you know, off you go. And you need to go back home, you just tell somebody else, and word would get around in the neighborhood, and eventually a car would show up and take you back home. So that's kind of how it worked. You know, one of the things that really was inspiring to me as I was writing this is just how much of a community, in every sense of that word, you know, Greenwood was. And that is, you know, before 1921, after 1921, well into the 60s, even after the highway program, Greenwood still, you know, held on to that community spirit, you know, and I felt it certainly when I arrived in Greenwood and got to know the community. You know, they were just so welcoming, you know, to me, who was an outsider, wasn't black, wasn't part of, you know, didn't know any of the families. And yet they still, you know, kind of took me in, you know. And so I just really, I felt that spirit then. I think it still exists today. You have this young generation of black entrepreneurs who are doing, you know, really incredible things like the Fire in Little Africa project and Silhouette Sneakers and Frio's Popsicles. And, you know, you really get a sense from the business community that everybody knows everybody else. They're still very well connected. And they're still really doing some amazing work.
Carlos Moreno, thanks very much for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Carlos Moreno is a graphic designer at CAP Oklahoma and a freelance journalist. His new book about the people that inhabited the Greenwood District before, during, and after the Tulsa Race Massacre is titled The Victory of Greenwood. He's also written a book for children and families titled A Kid's Book about the Tulsa Race Massacre. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.